Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. We moderns are not as technocratic as we believe we are. In fact, says Dr. David Suzuki in his new book, Wisdom of the Elders, we have a great deal to learn before we'll be half as intelligent as we once were. And Lester Brown, president of World Watch Institute, still speaks of dire consequences. But with a new administration about to come to Washington, this is a good sign.
When we'll see an enormous change in direction and an acceleration in the process of transforming what is now clearly an environmentally unsustainable economic system into one that is sustainable.
Some of the stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Many of us who profess environmental awareness trace our thinking to legends and poetry of Native Americans or other indigenous peoples around the world. The suggestion is that we are destroying Earth because we lack what we believe to be the simplicity of indigenous peoples' wisdom. Well, we are lacking this wisdom, says Dr. David Suzuki, but we should not consider this wisdom simple merely because it is ancient. In his new book, Wisdom of the Elders, Suzuki traces the parallels between indigenous people's wisdom and modern science.
I think if wisdom of the elders was to be summarized in a single word, what it's about, it would be respect. It's about respecting not only the natural world, but respecting other ways of seeing that world. You know, now in the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's arrival in the so-called New World, I think it's a time to reflect on the consequences of his arrival here. And I think the terrible things that have happened in North and South America since Columbus have resulted because the new arrivals here haven't had respect. We didn't respect the biological systems that existed here. We attempted to make over these continents in an image that we understood, and we didn't respect the Aboriginal people and the bodies of knowledge and the wisdom that they had. So I think what we're trying to do with Wisdom of the Elders is to recapture a sense of respect that will allow us to look at these knowledge bases with new eyes and with a different perspective.
Dr. David Suzuki is professor of genetics at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, and host of the popular television documentary series, The Nature of Things. In fact, we have reached him at the busy studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto as he prepares for taping a new edition of The Nature of Things. He is co-author of Wisdom of the Elders, along with biologist and writer Peter Knudsen. Says Suzuki, science is now becoming disconnected from its sources.
In my scientific career, it's become clear that as the scientific community has exploded in numbers and vigor, the fact is the world hasn't been getting better and better in direct relation to the amount of knowledge that we're gaining. So there seems to be a contradiction here, that scientists believe that through our acquisition of knowledge in bits and pieces, that we will gain the insights we need to make this world a better place.
Well, let me ask you, though, at this point, you talk about the need to rediscover that sense of respect for the natural world and its systems. How are you describing, or how would you see the re-bonding of that sense of respect with modern science?
Well, that's the interesting thing, that modern scientists, many people at the very leading edge of science, are now beginning to look at the world in a very different way. And I like to cite E.O. Wilson, who is one of the giants in biodiversity on the planet. He works at Harvard. And I interviewed Ed Wilson a few years ago and asked him how we stop this terrible rate of destruction, the extinction of species that's going on today. And his answer absolutely floored me. He said, we must learn to know our kin. The other animals and plants who are related to us through our DNA and our evolutionary history, because to learn to know our relatives is to come to love and cherish them. Now, I never would have believed that I would hear a scientist use words like love and cherish and who would speak of other species as our relatives. And when you think about that, of course, he's right that if we think of other living organisms as our biological relatives, then surely we would treat our relatives with greater respect and differently from if we just regard them as a commodity or as a resource.
The more he thought about this, the more Suzuki became astounded, not only that modern science should now be speaking such words, but more astounding, he says, is that science should ever have lost these words, once so large a part of indigenous languages.
There is a radically different perspective of Aboriginal people, indigenous people, and those of us in the industrialized world. For one thing, I think that we are influenced in our complex modern society. We are influenced by science to an enormous degree. And what science does is it fragments the world around us. We live in a very complex society in which there are all kinds of experts. And we see through the electronic media, we see the world in fragmented bits and pieces that don't cohere into a single kind of integrated worldview. We live in a fragmented world in time and space. Aboriginal people, on the other hand, would never think of themselves in any way as separate from the natural world. They see themselves as deeply immersed in it. So the whole notion of looking at their surroundings the way we do in science, that is, holding it at arm's length, looking at it through a telescope or a microscope, and attempting to be very objective about it, is simply not on for them. Their knowledge is based on their total immersion in it and an understanding that nature is beyond their ever total comprehension. And what makes their knowledge profound is that it works. They depend on their knowledge base for their very survival. So it has to be very practical, and it has to understand the complexity and the mysteries of the world that they live in.
Suzuki says our fragmentation and separation from the world around us is a fairly recent phenomenon since World War II and the sudden explosion of urban dwelling.
The amazing thing is the vast majority of children really have never seen a living cow or a chicken, and don't relate what they buy in supermarkets to things that grow in the ground or that were once living. When you tell a child that every bit of their nutrition was once a living plant or animal, they're shocked. We have come so far from a connection with our biological roots that when you say to someone, you really behaved like an animal last night, or you were a wild person, that's an insult. Because we regard animals as beneath us, that we're somehow not animals, we're different and superior to them.
Wisdom of the Elders is laid out in a most engaging fashion. The centerpiece of the work consists of a series of short chapters, each recounting a story from some indigenous people. Each chapter, in turn, is headed by a quote from a modern scientist or a modern elder, explaining in scientific terms just the story about to be told. These are not stories about primitive lifestyles and simple, unadorned cultures. Suzuki says the book builds from a central premise.
We try to emphasize very much what Claude Lévi-Strauss says. Claude Lévi-Strauss, the great French anthropologist, says that it is a great conceit of the West that we think that only great intellects and scientists have arisen since Aristotle and Einstein. But the fact is that since the beginning of time, in indigenous cultures everywhere on the earth, there have been men and women every bit as brilliant as Aristotle and Einstein. They have arisen, their ideas, their dreamings, their imagination has been incorporated into bodies of knowledge, handed down through countless generations of time. And those bodies of knowledge, which continue to reside in Aboriginal elders today, are the distillate of insights that must be respected every bit as much as what we received from Aristotle and Einstein.
Dr. David Suzuki, professor of genetics at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, host of The Nature of Things, and co-author of a new book titled Wisdom of the Elders, Honoring Sacred Native Visions of Nature. His partner in writing and research is Peter Knudsen, himself a biologist and writer. The book is available from Bantam Books. This is Bruce Robertson. Higher fuel efficiency standards for new cars and light trucks have cut pollution levels in many major U.S. cities. But the EPA estimates that as the number of cars on the road continues to grow, pollution levels will begin to rise, unless new cars are made even more efficient and older vehicles cleaner. Scott Schlegel looks at a new invention that may be especially useful in western cities where winter cold air inversions increase pollution hazards.
There's an older vehicle that was quite low emitting. What we typically find is if you're looking for a gross polluter, you'll very rarely find one less than a year old, less than 1%. But if you're looking at the oldest cars that come by, 1968, more than half of those are quite low emitting. Now, 40-45% sometimes are gross polluters.
Without drivers knowing it, University of Denver biology professor Donald Stedman is measuring pollution from their vehicles as they drive through a beam of light. The beam comes from a box about the size of a large briefcase, which is hooked up to a computer and a video camera. The camera photographs the rear of each car, including the license plate, as well as the levels of carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and hydrocarbons each car emits. Professor Stedman says the test results of nearly 500,000 cars in the U.S. and Europe raise questions about methods being used to reduce auto emissions.
Everywhere we look, we find half of the problem comes from 10% of the cars. A few gross polluters are out there doing all the work when it comes to polluting. And once you realize that, it doesn't really make sense to put mandatory oxy fuels in every car when they're really only going to improve 10% of the cars. So a lot of these programs where we're having everybody carpool or everybody vanpool or everybody take the use of these fuels, one could get a lot less costly, much more cost-effective emission reduction by identifying the dirty cars, and if you like, give them a subsidy to fix their car. It's very much more cost-effective to deal with the problem where the problem is than to try to deal with the problem as if everybody had it.
Staff at the Colorado Health Department's Air Quality Division agree that Stedman's emission sensor is a valuable tool for measuring pollution from vehicles on the road, but spokesperson Jerry Gallagher says it doesn't tell enough about the polluting vehicle.
What happens is the vehicle varies considerably during any driving cycle. As you would drive home tonight, your readings at any time could be a magnitude of 10, high or low. And our problem is that when you take it, one-second instantaneous reading of that, you could get a high reading or low reading from a vehicle and make the wrong decision on that vehicle, basically because of what mode that the vehicle is in, not necessarily the instrument. So it's the application of the instrument, and we have found when we have identified, or Dr. Stedman has identified, a vehicle that he calls dirty or a high reading, when in fact we bring that vehicle in and run a full test on it, we find it's very clean.
The new Clean Air Act requires that cars in more than 50 metropolitan areas in the U.S. be tested for emissions at various speeds and that remote sensing equipment be used to reduce vehicle emissions. Gallagher says remote sensors will also be used in Metro Denver, but he still questions their use for targeting specific high-emitting vehicles.
We plan on purchasing one of the units. We plan on taking the test. We plan on answering some of those questions. We plan on taking, in fact, the Act requires 0.5% of all the inventory must be tested this way. And I think that we want to be supportive of the process. What I don't want to do is start enforcing this on as an enforcement tool until those questions are answered.
Gallagher confirms that 10% of the vehicles create 50% of all vehicle emissions, but he questions how much reduction from those 10% is possible. In Provo City, Utah, police ticket drivers of visibly polluting vehicles. Use of remote sensing equipment is also being considered to help cut vehicle emissions in Provo, according to city spokesperson Raylene Ireland.
We are a valley surrounded by mountains, and during the inversion periods in the winter, we trap in those emissions, and it causes us a lot of difficulty. And we had felt all along that there had to be a percentage of our automobile population that was contributing to that problem more than the rest, and that if we could identify them in some way and have those vehicles repaired, that we could do some very efficient have some efficient gains in how well our program was doing.
Ireland says a city ordinance incorporating use of the emission sensor will be enacted as soon as the sensors have been acquired. They cost about $100,000 each, but can pay for themselves in a relatively short period of time. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Scott Schlegel.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. Lester Brown knows about vital signs. Not only is this the title of his latest book, his entire career has been given over to researching, writing, and prophesizing about the state of the planet and the direction of our life on it. For the most part, when we hear from Lester Brown, it is to hear of well-documented crises. Though he speaks soberly this time, he also has some words of encouragement.
Among these are the reduction in CFC production. This is the family of chemicals that's depleting the stratospheric ozone layer. And we were surprised and excited to learn when we pulled the data together, the historical data, that CFC production for the world has been reduced 46% over the last 3 years, from 1988 to 1991. This is a major advance for all of humanity, a major achievement for the international community to come together and agree on phasing out the production of this family of chemicals. Another exciting one is that in 1991, the world's strategic nuclear arsenal, that is the long-range missiles that carry nuclear warheads, was reduced by 19%. That is, 19% of them were dismantled in 1 year, almost all of them in the United States and the former Soviet Union as a result of arms control or disarmament agreements. Now, this doesn't eliminate the threat of nuclear war, but it does reduce the size of the arsenal, and that process is going to continue for some years. But perhaps more importantly, the conditions in the world that permitted the dismantlement. I mean, the United States is actually helping the Soviets now dismantle their nuclear warheads, their intercontinental ballistic missiles. It's an amazing development. I mean, they've asked us for technical assistance. That's a major achievement. Another trend that's encouraging is the decline in global military expenditures. In 1990, global military expenditures dropped 6%. This is after roughly four decades of continuously rising global military expenditures. In 1991 and 1992, we expect that trend to continue. It may even gain momentum. Now, 6% doesn't sound like a lot, but 6% of $1 trillion is $60 billion. That's more than the entire third world spends on family planning, reforestation, and soil conservation, for example. So it's not inconsequential.
Now, to be sure, this is a fairly lengthy description of our positive realignment, and right we are to feel encouraged, if not actually proud. But as the saying goes, first the good news, now the bad.
Probably the economic trend that I am most concerned about is the decline in per capita grain production for the world that's been underway now since 1984. From 1950 until 1984, grain production expanded at nearly 3% per year, while population was expanding at just under 2%. So there was a 1% gain on average each year over a 34-year period. So this increase in grain production per person of just over a third for the world helped improve diets throughout much of the world. But since 1984, world grain output has expanded at about 1% per year, and population is still growing at nearly 2%. So this means a decline of almost 1% per year over the last 8 years. This, I think, is a matter for concern.
Brown says decline in grain production worldwide is due not to drought or global warming, as you might expect. Rather, the explanation is quite simple. The amount of available cropland has not increased in step with growth in world population. In other words, the same amount of cropland is not feeding many millions more people. Your refrigerator is no larger, but you are to feed many more guests this season. like that.
The other thing that's now disturbing is that the demand for water around the world is beginning to push against the limits of the hydrological cycle. So the growth in irrigation has slowed dramatically, and in per capita terms, the amount of fresh water per person used in agriculture is also declining. So now the world's farmers are faced with a shrinking cropland area per person and a shrinking amount of fresh water per person to use in agriculture. So these two things are combining to slow the growth in world food output. And this, I think, is an issue that's going to preoccupy national political leaders for years to come.
In fact, in his upcoming State of the World report, due out early next year, Brown makes the case that water will replace oil as the commodity or natural resource over which nations will argue, if not actually go to war. There are other factors combining to sound the trumpets of alarm.
One of the things we're now beginning to see is the various forms of environmental degradation, such as soil erosion, possibly global warming, depletion of the stratospheric ozone layer, all having a negative effect on food production trends. We estimate, for example, that the world's farmers are losing some 24 billion tons of topsoil per year from their cropland in excess of natural soil formation. That's about the amount of topsoil on Australia's wheat land, so it's not an inconsequential loss.
Now, is that loss of topsoil, is that a result of misuse of the land by agricultural practices, or is that a part of a natural cycle of hydrological changes?
For the most part, this loss of topsoil is a result of increasingly intensive cultivation of land.
Another contributing force is a technique many farmers use, even here in the United States, of planting only one crop year after year in response to world food demands. Corn, for example, while much in demand, is also very demanding on the soil, requiring a great deal of nutrition, either natural or from applied fertilizers. To make the land produce more corn than it would or should degrades the soil. Eventually, it blows away, literally. Another factor not to be discounted, says Brown, is the threat of global warming. The threat, even though its existence has not been proven.
There have always been fluctuations in climate. Some years are warmer and some are cooler. But in 1988, in the United States, severe heat and drought reduced crop production below reduced grain production below consumption for the first time in our history. This could be a window on the future of what agriculture would be like in a world with ever hotter summers. So I think we should take seriously the threat of global warming.
In the final analysis, says Brown, comparing the positive factors with those causing concern, it is clear we are not moving fast enough in the race. The dark factors are gaining. And as we move toward the 21st century, it is equally clear that, whether in Africa or the Pacific Northwest, in Eastern Europe or the Philippines, environmental degradation brings economic hardship. In the examples we have cited, misused farmland not only is an environmental liability, it is an economic loss as well.
My own sense is that the election on November 3rd in the United States may be one of those hinge points in history when we'll see an enormous change in direction and an acceleration in the process of transforming what is now clearly an environmentally unsustainable economic system into one that is sustainable.
Lester Brown, president of World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. His new book is titled Vital Signs, The Trends That Are Shaping Our Future, published by W.W. Norton, New York, New York, detailing, as we have heard, both the good news and the bad. And this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, program number 152. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.